Find something of value.
A higher education community in South Africa and unintellectualization.
How central this humanity is.
Welcome to The Academic Citizen. I'm your host, Nosipho Mgomezulu. In this seventh season of our podcast, we're excited to explore the role of audio in creating possibilities for new ways of disseminating knowledge. Over the course of this season, you will hear insights from scholars from across the world presenting papers at the Sound Matter Symposium hosted in 2023 by the South African Research Chair in Science Communication, The Academic Citizen, and the South African Journal of Science. In our third episode, Professor Ikani reflects on the work by André van Wyk on practices of re-narrativizing the past through sound. Through careful active listening, the episode allows us to think through André's process of recollecting and remembering a sonic archive of place. As we think about sonic archival practices in this episode, we listen with Dr. John Cannenberg to rethink the Brick and Mortar Museum. Dr. Cannenberg is an artistic researcher whose current work investigates sounds as museological objects. John leads an institution that exists in a single mobile phone, dedicated to the collection, curation, and display of sounds as objects of cultural heritage, while critiquing conventional museum practices and music industry imposed limitations on the digital distribution of sound. The Museum of Portable Sound explores questions related to sonic cultures, museology, digital heritage, media archaeology, and the visual cultures of sound. Let's have a listen.
Thank you for inviting me to take part in this symposium. My name is John Cannenberg, and I'm the director and chief curator of the Museum of Portable Sound. Today, I'm going to be giving you an overview and guided tour of the galleries of science and technology at the museum. The Museum of Portable Sound began as the practice portion of my practice-based PhD, which I completed at the University of Arts London in 2020. So what exactly is the Museum of Portable Sound? It began in 2015 as a curated collection of sounds on one iPhone. This iPhone, and only this iPhone. The sounds are only available on this mobile phone. They're not available for download anywhere. As I like to say, it's not an app, it's an experience. The museum's mission statement says that it's dedicated to collecting, exhibiting, preserving, and researching primarily non-musical sounds as museum objects. In terms of the sounds in the museum, the vast majority of them are drawn from my own field recordings that I've been making for over two decades. I made these recordings for years without really knowing what I wanted to do with them. At first, I was trying to be an experimental musician, but that never felt very comfortable to me. And then one day it hit me. Maybe these sounds belong in a museum. This was very heavily influenced by my participation in the Museum Studies program at the University of Michigan when I was doing my master's there. And I had started thinking about how sound is normally encountered in museums as sort of a support to visual objects. I started thinking, well, what if sound was the museum itself? In terms of how people visit the Museum of Portable Sound, what usually happens is a person contacts me, we arrange a place to meet, and when that day arrives, I show up, I hand them the phone, I hand them a map, which I'll show you in more detail later, and I show them the museum's gallery guide, which is a 300-page book that I've designed and written, which shows all of the waveforms of all the sounds and has photos and texts, all the things that would usually be on the walls of a more typical museum. And then we sit there and they listen to my phone. We end up having really in-depth discussions about the things that they've listened to in the museum. And these conversations are really what I think turns the museum into a true museum experience. And once the COVID pandemic began, I started offering online visits as well. Now I want to show you how the sounds are organized on the phone, which brings us back to the museum's map. So the museum is organized into four floors. each of which uses a taxonomy that is typical of how museums have historically categorized the physical world. And I've applied these categorizations to sound. So we have floor one, which is natural history, floor two, science and technology, floor three, architecture and urban design, and floor four, art and culture. Today, we're going to be focusing on floor two, science and technology. The first gallery is gallery seven, and it's a history of sound recording. Next is a gallery dedicated to acoustics and audiology. Then there are two galleries dedicated to audio equipment, one from last century and one from the 21st century. Then a gallery of audio interfaces, a gallery dedicated to the sounds of machines, a gallery of glitches, one of the more popular galleries because I think people enjoy that it's not just their devices that stop working. A gallery dedicated to laboratories and medicine, a new gallery, astronomy and space exploration. And then finally, we have gallery 16, the five most annoying sounds in the world. And now, let's start your guided tour of the science and technology wing of the Museum of Portable Sound. Okay, so here we are in gallery 7. And this first sound that I'm going to play for you is the first recording of a human voice, 17 years before Thomas Edison. This recording was made by a man named Edward Leon Scott de Martinville. He's a Frenchman who lived in Paris, and he made this recording in the year 1860. He used his invention, which is known as the phonautograph, to capture sound through a cone via a needle into blackened paper. So it only captured the imagery of sound. This phonautogram, which is actually the one that I'll be playing for you, if you look at it close up, you can see very clearly that there are sound waves that have been captured on this piece of paper. Now, Scott de Martinville wasn't able to play these recordings back, but in 2008, a researcher in the United States named Patrick Feaster figured out a way to digitally recreate the original sound that's captured in these phonautograms. So I will play the sound for you now, and I have to caution you, the recording is not very good, but it is the sound of Edward Leon Scott de Martinville himself. So what you just heard was Scott de Martinville singing a traditional French folk song named Au Clair de la Lune, which at this time in 1860, was already a very old folk tune. Next, we have another sound from the history of sound recording. This is an example of how the compact cassette was used as digital data storage for home computers in the early 1980s. I purchased this cassette on eBay, and I found a really interesting artifact on the cassette. This part of the waveform is the actual binary computer code of one particular program. But at the very end, you wind up hearing whoever owned this cassette originally accidentally starting to tape over it. And this is something that happened all the time to those of us who had personal computers at home in the early 80s. Moving on to the acoustics and audiology gallery, here we have the sound of the world's first electrical white noise machine. And I say electrical specifically because it turns out there was a non-electrical white noise machine invented in the 17th century by the famous Italian sculptor Bernini, who invented it as a gift for Pope Clement IX, who suffered from terrible insomnia. Bernini's machine was a manually operated wheel, which when spun, it would rapidly hit a series of paper globes that simulated the sound of white noise, essentially. However, what you're going to hear is the sound of the original electrical white noise machine, which was invented in 1962 by a traveling salesman in the United States. He had noticed that his wife, who had trouble sleeping, often slept better where the room was air-conditioned. And he figured out that it wasn't the cold that was allowing her to sleep at night. It was the sound of the air conditioner. So he created a device that he called a sleepmate. All it is essentially is a plastic box with a fan inside of it. And this design is still sold today. Next, we have the sound of Q, the world's first genderless voice assistant in Gallery 11 audio interfaces, first released the 8th of March, 2019.
Hi, I'm Q, the world's first genderless voice assistant. Think of me like Siri or Alexa, but neither male nor female. I'm created for a future where we are no longer defined by gender, but rather how we define ourselves. My voice was recorded by people who neither identify as male nor female, and then altered to sound gender neutral, putting my voice between 145 and 175 hertz, a range defined by audio researchers.
Unfortunately, Q never seemed to really catch on, and now the website, genderlessvoice.com, seems to have become reviews of headphones and cables and things like that. Moving on to Gallery 14, Laboratories and Medicine, we have the sound of me having a root canal operation. And actually, I'll probably just spare you of having to listen to this. The newest gallery in the science and technology floor is Gallery 15, Astronomy and Space Exploration. And the first sound from it that I'd like to play for you is the sound of Sputnik 1, the first artificial satellite to orbit the Earth on the 4th of October, 1957. And as it orbited the Earth, it broadcast this repeated tone. And that tone could be picked up on any home radio system. And when this was discovered in the United States, it started a bit of a panic because people feared that this was some sort of secret code or some kind of sonic attack. Next is the sound of flying through the rings of Saturn. And this was recorded in December of 2016. And it's the sound of the Cassini-Huygens spacecraft, which was a joint effort between NASA and the European Space Agency. And it's flying through what's come to be known as the Janus Epimetheus ring. You can see the ring here in this photo if you look for the black cross near the right-hand side of the photo. What you're going to hear is the sound of ice particles exploding against the surface of Cassini. When each one of these particles exploded, it created a short radio burst because Cassini was traveling at thousands of miles per hour. These radio bursts were picked up by Cassini's antennas, and so you're hearing radio static that sounds almost exactly like ice particles hitting the hull of the probe. The last sound is from Gallery 16, the five most annoying sounds in the world. This was actually a temporary exhibition that I put together during the COVID pandemic, and it became so popular that I decided to make it a permanent gallery in the museum. This exhibition was based on a real scientific research study that took place between 2008 and 2012 and had two publications related to it in the Journal of the Acoustical Society of America and the Journal of Neuroscience. They prepared a large collection of sounds that people generally dislike, and they played them for a group of students at Newcastle University in the UK. And they collated the data, and they came up with a ranking of all of the most annoying sounds in the world. And my exhibition presents the top five of that list. The most annoying sound in the world, scientifically determined by this study, allegedly, is the sound of a knife being rubbed against a glass bottle. I wish I could show you more, but I'm out of time. Thank you so much for listening.
John is not your traditional museum curator. Which is just as well, because the Museum of Portable Sound is no ordinary museum. This intimate experiment between a visitor the museum's curator, and the museum's collection of non-musical sounds, all kept on one cell phone, challenges what we think of when we imagine a museum and the place of sound within it. Usually, when we speak of museums, we conjure up an institution which has historically been housed in brick-and-mortar structures, or, in more recent years, digitized collections of objects from museums that have been made available online. Megan McShear, the audiovisual archivist at the Archives of American Art at the Smithsonian Institute, argues that the internet is at best a highly unstable storage environment. To this, John's work asks us to not simply question what sounds and museums represent, but rather what sound does and the processes through which recorded sounds come to matter. Treating sound as an object of culture is just one of the many ways that John disrupts our conceptions of museum practices. As I listen to John, I can't help but think about the archiving of Indigenous knowledge in physical and digital archives of traditional museums. Questions about access, ownership, and stewardship of living cultural objects are fraught, bringing us into direct confrontation with how sound, along with other cultural artifacts, have been commodified. Who gets to own sounds has been hotly debated in numerous spheres, from the music recording industry increasingly threatened by streaming platforms and artists contesting the appropriation of their work through AI. Who gets to own sound has been at the heart of contestations in the case of restitution of Indigenous artifacts. This question asks us, who is the rightful custodian of Indigenous sonic and material artifacts kept in gilded cages, divorced from ever-evolving living cultures in the name of preservation? For the past few weeks, I've been working at the Library of Things We Forgot to Remember, a space created by Kudzanai Chuorai in Johannesburg. Like John's work, the library is a living space, an archive of materials including vinyls, posters, paintings, and more, drawn from private African collections. These artifacts aren't kept behind glass cases, but the visitor is invited to be present with the collections that trigger memories of things we may have forgotten to remember. It would have been so simple for John to have made an app and uploaded the sounds he collects and curates. Rather, he invites his audiences to sit with him, to listen closely, and allow for the transmission of affects or feelings which have often been rendered superfluous in our busy modern lives, including in our own academic practices. Thinking with the Museum of Portable Sound is to think through an institution otherwise. We are asked to slow down and become more attentive to the history and processes of curation and its inextricable relation between people and places. In the vein of Donna Haraway, I ask, what do I touch when I touch a museum that lives in a cell phone? As the world becomes ever conscious of the invisibilization of how cell phone technology comes to be in our hands through coltan mining and the many Congolese workers who are exploited and the wars that displace millions of people to give us the technology, I have to think about the many entangled histories that make up institutions such as museums. John's anti-museum practices are an audacious reminder for us to widen the scope of our attention, to listen carefully, not only to the product, but also the processes and practices that make up our sonic academic engagements. We thank John for sharing his provocations with us. You can learn more about how to visit the museum by visiting his website, www.museumofportablesound.com. This episode of The Academic Citizen was hosted by me, Nosipho Mgomezulu. It was produced and promoted by Fumani Dwaga and edited by Audrey Burnett. Our opening jingle was designed by Victoria De La Harp. The Academic Citizen is funded by the South African Research Chair in Science Communication, which in turn is funded by the South African National Research Foundation. We thank Dr. John Cannenberg for their presentation at the Sound Matters Symposium in November 2023. You can listen to all our podcasts, including our archive of previous seasons, at www.theacademiccitizen.org. You can also follow us on all the socials at The Academic Citizen. We welcome feedback at our email address, theacademiccitizen@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.